That I am the perfect woman for you, and you choose me to be your bride. I will be your friend, your lover, and your partner throughout whatever life has to offer us. We'll have joy, maybe a few tears, but more ups than downs, and you will never be bored.
Well, it started out as a sweepstone for the Fox Network, but snowballed into something a bit more serious. What was supposed to be a fairy tale marriage between multimillionaire Rick Rockwell and contestant Darva Conger turned grim pretty quickly. Darva said she had no idea what she was getting into, and that she and Rick have now signed an annulment agreement. I talked with Mr. Rockwell earlier and asked him how much of How to Marry a Millionaire material he is now using in his stand-up act.
I guess it's probably as much catharsis as the audience will allow me at this point.
Do you make fun of yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to me, this whole thing is one big self-deprecating mess, I guess.
Do you take on Darva in your skit as well?
No. I've had so many negative things hurled at me over the past couple weeks, and so much said about me, and so many people speculating about what's in my heart and what's in my head, that I really can't find it in myself to go out and attack other people. To me, that's just counterproductive. I'd rather speak to what was inside me and what was I feeling and what's happened to me, and try and make some sense of it all and hopefully laugh at it somewhat.
Have you made any sense of it at all?
Yeah, I think I have. I actually did the show because I felt like it was fate or destiny or something like that, and trying to create a romantic journey. And
You really believe that you could fall in love with this person that you sort of handpicked on television in front of millions of people?
I sure thought there was a chance. I mean, I kind of looked at it as though, hey, there's 6 billion people in the world, and somehow my path has led me here. And I thought, this is just too strange for it not to be happening for a reason. And obviously I found out now that that reason wasn't because I was going to find love. And I don't know, as near as I can figure it at this point, Paula, it's, you know, my job is to try and bring laughter to people and maybe raise some money for charity along the way. That's all I can make out of it at this point.
Because, as you know, people have accused you of using this opportunity to really jumpstart your career. Was there any part of you that was sucked into it because of that?
Well, I think any logical person would say, and you know, I do public speaking, and I
America is the sorriest country on this damn planet. These fools have the nerve to smash down the poor gays and lesbians Proposition 22 and tell them that they can't get married because it's unnatural. And at the same time, these pro-sorry capitalists, Americans with their traditional American God-fearing values, place what as their primary force on marriage, on national TV, in front of the whole damn world? Money. Not values. Not this fool's belief systems, if he has any. Is he pro-abortion? Is he anti-abortion? What are his religious beliefs? All you yahoos like to yap about. You talk about there's too much sex on TV. No good role models. No good role models for women. And what role do you have women in? In some kind of submissive fairy tale nonsense, waiting for some goon rich white male to take you off to the oasis. Man, it's time for a new day. It's slave revolt time. Listening to 104.1, 93.7, 96.3, and love.com. Slave Revolt Radio Time. Tonight we have Gerald kicking it off with the Making It Plain news update. As he'll go into Mr. McCain, you know, Mr. Insane, and other issues concerning Mumia and on. Then, in dedication to the true struggle for women's liberation, I'll be doing a commentary on Sister Harriet Tubman. And then we got a shameless file. So we have all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
Brotherhood of a select group of liars, cheaters, and thieves who use that brotherhood to form the most arbitrary and ambiguous history the world has come to know. Red, white, and blue, the symbolism of hypocrisy and bureaucratic stagnation. Men of power glossing the fault line cracks. In historical facts, red, white, and blue, those stars and stripes for never. Never again will I take a back seat, genuflect those my equal, sing that whining anthem or tatter my clothing with those tired ass colors. Blue. Blue is the mood that sweeps my emotions into a disastrousness of color me sad. Color me gray, color me gloomy when thinking of those colors, patriotic white. White are the ghost-faced pointed hoods swinging my ancestor from the tree that fed life back into earth to breed in abundance the fork-tongued serpent, erecting sacrilegious torches in the face of the phoenix who takes flight up out of the ash, leaving that glow in its dust, its winged span spreading a shadow over hatred. And I see red. Red are my bloodshot eyes streaming tears down that flag shrouded in glory, glory, hallelujah. My country, tears of thee, waving embers across purple mountains, majestic only to those who believe. While in the sky, atmospheric radiation beams down, singeing surf and turf, blistering the feet of the unprepared, running, running, running from those poisonous rays, seeking to alleviate your pain, caking your face with sunblock 2000, covering up your face, covering up your skin, covering up your history of bad blood and foul misinterpretations. Running from each other, running out of the frying pan and into the fiery douses of hell, and forever will you burn with those crosses of iniquity, and let those you've abused inherit your precious earth. So fly your flag in hell, till streaming down its acts of change and cover-up that have insistently been deemed necessary, and I will cry. Cry social injustice, cry racism, cry sacrilege, cry freedom from sea to shining sea. My tears will not provide you with escape. And you, Your pointed hoods and your smoking crosses shall burn forever, marching in the parade of hell's fire and brimstone.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Yes, good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News Service. Well, got a lot of information for you today. I want to start off with an international note to give you a little comparison about how industrial disputes are dealt with in different parts of the world. The International Workers of the World from Warsaw, they now have a branch in Warsaw, IWW, same old, Industrial Workers of the World, excuse me, same old people we know right here in Berkeley, has visited the gelatin factory in Bronica between Torun and another city in Poland, which is occupied by a workers' committee. It used to be state-owned. It was sold to Grabik, gelatin baron. But Grabik didn't fulfill his obligations under the contract about employment conditions and investments. So about 6 months ago, the workers have, quote, evacuated the bosses on wheelbarrows, unquote. That's the Polish way of firing a boss. And continued production without them. There have been threats of cutting supply from the government, but none of this has happened. Currently, there are two lawsuits against the workers and against the bosses. So that's interesting. In Poland, they take over the plant and they wheel the bosses out of the factory when they have an industrial dispute. Okay. South Africa, once again on the international scale. I wanted to bring this to your attention because, unlike the normal information, this is somewhat complex. Can a government that is primarily run by blacks be racist? Can newspapers, primarily corporate newspapers owned by whites, be anti-racist? Or is it the reverse? South Africa, the enigma. There is presently a battle in South Africa over racism and press freedom. The subpoena landed on the editor's desk on a Friday afternoon last month. It ordered him to appear before the country's Human Rights Commission, which was investigating racism in the media. It said he must account for his newspaper's reporting or face up to 6 months in jail. All told, the commission issued 36 such subpoenas to editors, white and black, of the newspapers, radio, and television stations. And in a country where freedom of the press was only recently enshrined in the Constitution, where newspapers were frequently closed and journalists arrested under the apartheid regime, the subpoenas inevitably sent shivers through the newsrooms. I thought, my God, said the editor, Philip Van Newkirk, who is white and who runs the Mail and Guardian in Johannesburg, a weekly there. I didn't expect them to go that far. The jackboot approach is something we thought we'd gotten away from. In the outcry that ensued, the subpoenas were withdrawn and the editors agreed to appear voluntarily before the commission. Mr. Van Newkirk and other white editors say they're willing to discuss the issue. They just don't want to be forced to discuss the issue. Nevertheless, the hearing on racism in the media, which started this week, has set off a debate over whether the commission and the government of President Thabo Mbeki are trying to stifle criticism and dissent in the press. It is no secret that Mr. Mbeki, who is the president of South Africa, and his ruling party, the African National Congress, remain deeply suspicious of the white-dominated news media, party and government officials who helped write the country's new constitution say white journalists from seem intent on discrediting the black government and typically disregard issues important to the black community. Most of the nation's politically influential newspapers, including Mr. Van Newkirk's Mail and Guardian, are run by white editors. There are also several popular newspapers directed at black readers, of which the largest is the daily tabloid, The Sowetan. Mr. Mbeke, the African National Congress, and commission members deny that they want to muzzle the media, but they rarely sugarcoat their criticism. The ANC applauded the commission for using the subpoenas. Last month, in its annual report, the ruling party described the media as a, quote, hostile press, unquote. This is, and I quote, still primarily owned and controlled by antagonistic forces with minority interests, unquote. Those opinions are increasingly shared by black editors. At today's hearing, five black editors broke ranks with their white colleagues to support the commission's investigation, which has been largely derided by whites. The black editors testify that the media still portrays blacks as corrupt and incompetent, focuses almost exclusively on the white minority, and drowns out the stories and concerns of ordinary black people. Quote, it is our contention that in a country like South Africa, it simply cannot be right that because its dominance in the media, minorities should continue to set the public agenda, said Mike Chiluma, editor of The Sowetan, the nation's largest daily. The black editors said the issue was so important that they would have willingly testified under subpoena, which stunned their white counterparts, who have unanimously attacked the subpoenas as an infringement on press freedom. And I quote, we're talking about a rainbow nation, but we're still living in different places, said Mr. Van Newkirk. Many of the editors, black and white, battled apartheid in South Africa and suffered for it. In 1988, Mr. Van Newkirk, who worked at what was then the Weekly Mail, saw his newspaper shuttered temporarily because the government decided it had portrayed the ANC guerrillas favorably. Mr. Sullivan, the white editor of the Star, the Johannesburg Star, who then worked for the liberal Rand Daily Mail, was forced to justify his reporting before a government commission in the 1970s. Agrey Klaster, the black editor-in-chief of the Sowetan, was jailed for 6 months in 1977 after the government closed what was then the Sunday World. All three men run influential newspapers. All agree that the commission's interim report on racism in the media, which was the foundation of the investigation, was seriously flawed. The report, for instance, criticized a photograph of two black birds near an overflowing garbage can, saying the birds depicted Johannesburg's black downtown and the garbage can its decay. Now that is crazy. Now see here, that becomes pretty clear that they trying to just stifle, because that's interpretive, man. You can't be stopping people from publishing pictures by some crazy delusion that you impute to it. Wow. All agree that the subtle racism and stereotyping described in the recent reports continues to surface in newspapers and television and radio broadcasts. We mirror a very racist society, Mr. Sullivan said. If there were no racism in the media, it would be absolutely astounding. But that is where the similarities end. The white editors say that they are already working hard to hire blacks and to carefully scrutinize coverage, and that the commission's investigation was, for the most part, unnecessary. The black editors disagree. Uh-oh. After this week's hearing, the commission will present its recommendations to Parliament. People must not pretend that these things are normal when they are not, Mr. Klaster said. That's the Sowetan one once again. The country is run by white people economy-wise. These newspapers are run by white people. We know that. There's no point in trying to be coy about this kind of thing. They say there is racism in the media, but they say that and do nothing about it. The commission began looking at the two issues, the issue about 2 years ago when the Black Lawyers Association and the Association of Black Accountants called for biased inquiries into two newspapers, including the Mail and Guardian. The groups pointed out that the Mail and Guardian had written 14 times about allegedly corrupt blacks, but only 4 times about whites. Aye. Journalists counter that should not be surprising, since the most government officials these days are black. They also note that the major newspapers have given Mr. Mbeki some favorable coverage. Mr. Mbeki and Trevor Manuel, the finance minister, received rave reviews last month for major speeches. The Mail and Guardian, evaluating the new government, gave Mr. Mbeki an A- for his first few months in office. According to the commission's statistics, progress has been made in the hiring and promotion of blacks, but whites still overwhelmingly dominate the top tiers of management. Last year, the government said about 76% of the country's top media managers were white, as compared to 88% in 1994. But whites are not the only ones to voice concerns about Mr. Mbeki's commitment to freewheeling discussion and critique. Earlier this year, 2 black professors complained about what they described as the dampening of dissent within the ruling party in a column in the recently revived Sunday World newspaper. And last year, Trevor Ngawenani, an African National Congress councilman in Johannesburg, was suspended from his party positions for publicly criticizing the ANC-led council's planned privatization of government services. Parks Makanalana, a spokesman for President Mbeki, says the Human Rights Commission, an independent body that reports to Parliament, is no mouthpiece for Mr. Mbeki. Last year, he notes, the commission sharply criticized the government for seeming to scale back rights of accused criminals and began an investigation into the government's interim policy against the distribution of the anti-AIDS drug, AZT. Well, Mr. Mankanalana emphasizes that it was the black government, not the white government, that gave this country its first constitutionally protected rights to free speech, and that's quite true. Interesting, but confusing, because the sad fact is the ANC, as an organization, has spawned so many corrupt elements that they themselves had to, you know, expel and get away from them, that it's actually, I've never seen a party come to power and have that many corruption scandals almost right out the gate. So it's a mixed bag, you know. Obviously, there's still racism, but I tend to think that the ANC is a little, I don't know, let's say shy on the criticism, don't want to be criticized, a little oversensitive. Yeah, the ANC came out against AZT being distributed to blacks in South Africa. I don't know why. I think it was a political reason. I don't think it's because of a chemical analysis. I think it's because they're fighting against the United States, trying to get the United States to give them the AIDS drugs for free, and the United States won't do it. So they said, well, ain't no sense in giving it out at all then. That's where I think they're coming from.
Well, I had read an article and did it on Slave Revolt where Mbeki at least stated that the problem he had with AZT was its toxicity, and that many nations around the world were fighting and taking GlaxoSmithKline, who manufactures AZT, to court. It was interesting because in the San Jose Mercury, then they went ahead and denied it and backed GlaxoSmithKline, saying that they don't know what he's talking about and so on and so forth. Then someone from South Africa had sent me and some others an actual TV show where this was a hot debate, where GlaxoSmithKline was actually admitting that, yes, there are nations and people who are challenging the use of AZT.
Well, I have my apologies there, Gracie. I'm sorry. I did not read the article that you just referred to. And I know that the ANC has been going back and forth with the U.S. government over the question of AIDS drugs being given to Africa. So I'm sorry, but I thought that's what it was about. I need to investigate a little more deeply, it looks like. And that's why none of us is smart as all of us. See, I kind of dig it when somebody can correct me and and helped me to see something that I didn't formerly see. Well, here's something that I've seen for some time, we've all seen, and I think it's almost oaky. You know, in the United States, if a young woman abandons a child and she is caught and that child dies, they will, well, they're prosecuted for murder is what they do. And this they have found, well, to be kind, not so useful. Death of unwanted babies prompts a call to ease laws in the United States. This is the richest country in the world, remember? How do you get babies in garbage cans in the richest country in the world? Simple white crosses and pinwheels spinning quietly in the breeze mark the graves of 38 abandoned babies buried in a cemetery in California. Anonymous in death, the babies were given names and proper funerals by a stranger. This lady, Debbie Forrest, kind of took it upon herself to spend about $30,000 to have funerals and graves for these abandoned babies, right? It was really overwhelming when you get to a coroner's office. They bring you a child wrapped in plastic, and you can look at its face, Miss Forrest said. Whose own children are 22, 19, and 14. So she went on this quest to try and work against the abandonment of babies. It's just one problem. Well, truth be told, they cut off the welfare. They meddling with the abortion every time you turn around talking about partial birth, this and all this madness. There are some states where a woman cannot get an abortion. So there are only sketchy statistics on how many babies are abandoned in public places each year. Relying on news reports, the Department of Health and Human Services, that's crazy that the Department of Health and Human Services would rely on news reports. What do? If they don't count things like this, it's crazy. They're relying on the newspapers, but nevertheless, determined that 65 babies, 8 of whom died, were left in public places in 1991. That's absolutely false. I can tell you that it's way more than that. In 1998, there were 105 such abandonments, and 33 of the babies were found dead. To give that number some context, officials noted that 22,000 babies were left in hospitals in 1991. 22,000. Welcome to America. Many by drug addicted or HIV infected mothers. The number increased to 31,000 in 1998. Typically, babies recovered by the authorities are placed up for adoption. So what's happened is they've created all these repressive laws, and they have actually tried and convicted women for, you know, abandoning their babies, and it's gone up. It just done spiraled is what done happened, see? And now, instead of people leaving them at the hospital, they just leave them in the garbage can because, well, the garbage can don't ask no questions. So they trying now to have this thing where you can leave the baby. You just got to tell the police you're leaving the baby and sign stuff. Ain't nobody going to deal with no damn police, fool. What's wrong with these people? The fact of the matter is, this is an indicator of how wonderful life is in this country for young women. I can safely predict the problem will only get worse, and it's not because I want it to be that way. This is something I'd like to be wrong about also. Now, they've been going on and on about this quality of life crap, and here I have some information about this whole a counter argument to the argument that the cities like New York, you know, where they have the quality control and the death squads killing up everybody, that's the way that you deal with crime. Here is another view. Cities reduce crime and conflict without the New York-style hardball. With the city's stunning drop in crime in the 1990s, many New Yorkers have come to assume that aggressive police tactics and crime reductions are inextricably linked, not just New Yorkers. This is something that people all over the country mistakenly link together. Police brutality and safety. Diminishing civil rights and safety. This is common. But a look at other cities around the nation suggests that large reductions in crime can be achieved in places that rely less on confrontational law enforcement measures New York has used, like the stopping and searching of thousands of people for guns by the Street Crimes Unit, four of which officers were acquitted in the killing of Amadou Diallo. In fact, some cities, notably San Diego and Boston, have recorded as big or even larger drops in violence while employing strategies that rely on close cooperation between the police and the community and have ended up improving race relations. In the eyes of many police chiefs and criminologists, San Diego and Boston have become the national models of policing, and while New York's accomplishments are also studied and admired, there is a sense of sadness that a great opportunity has been squandered. And I quote, "To see crime rates down but people still fearful of the police is not a healthy situation," said Jeremy Travis, the director of the National Institute of Justice, the research arm of the Justice Department, and a former deputy police commissioner in New York. Now, you hear that? To see crime rates down, but people still fearful of the police. They don't want that. They want you to go hug Officer Friendly. You see? But it betrays the objective reality. Oh, my. What are they to do? Well, the national challenge, according to this gentleman, is to bring crime down while simultaneously enhancing public confidence in the agencies of justice. They got a problem. And that is what has dropped out of the picture in New York. Raina Sampson, a former police sergeant in New York who is director of public safety for the University of San Diego, said, and I quote, "New York has paid a huge price. What the NYPD did was throw people at the problem, putting cops on every corner. But who wants to live in a society like that?" But New York City police officials dispute suggestions that the department is more confrontational than others, and they say that its outreach efforts do not receive enough attention. Quote, "The commissioner and the precinct commanders do community meetings all the time," said Maureen Casey, a deputy commissioner for policy and planning. "Not only in the feedback is the feedback positive, but consistently the thing that the community asks for is more police officers. They got 30,000. Now that's sick. You want more. You got 30,000 police officers in New York. They want more. Oh, boy. Statistically, New York, Boston, and San Diego have all achieved enormous declines since crime began dropping nationally in 1991. From 91 to 98, the murder rate fell 76.4% in San Diego, the largest decline in any major city, with New York second at 70.6% and Boston third at 69.3%. According to Alfred Bloomstein, a professor of criminology at the Carnegie Mellon University of Pittsburgh, their robbery rates showed a similar pattern. During these same years, the robbery rate dropped 62.6% in San Diego, also the steepest decline, and 60.1% in New York and 50.2% in Boston. But the three cities employed very different strategies. New York stressed tough enforcement. San Diego pioneered community and problem-solving policing. And Boston developed an approach combining careful research, participation by local ministers, and selective action against the worst criminals. Several other large cities have also reported sharp decreases in crime. The murder rate fell 62.8% in San Antonio from 1991 to 1998, 61.3% in Houston, 59.3% in Los Angeles, and now we know what kind of policing they're getting in Los Angeles. So what does that tell you? That's telling you that maybe it ain't got nothing to do with the police. But I'm sorry. Let me finish giving you all the information, then we'll comment, all right? Crazy. And 52.4% in Dallas. Without it, as coherent a strategy as those in New York, San Diego, or Boston, which is basically what they're saying, it may have nothing to do with the police. Indeed, law enforcement experts acknowledge that they are baffled by the decline in Los Angeles, whose police department has been plagued by scandals and low morale and has seen a drop in arrests. These suggest some or much of the nationwide reduction in crime may well stem from the factors beyond better policing, like longer police sentences, prison sentences, the improved economy, and changes in the attitude of young people towards drugs and crime. One way to understand the variations in police tactics in different cities is to look at the cities themselves and their leaders, say Herman Goldstein, a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin Law School, perhaps the most widely respected authority on policing. I quote, "A community gets the policing it deserves or demands," he says. Nobody deserves the policing they get in L.A. Take it easy there, buddy. In New York, under Mayor Rudolph W. Giuliani, a former federal prosecutor, and his first police commissioner, William J. Bratton, there was a two-pronged approach. They began a new emphasis on the rigorous collection of crime statistics and holding precinct commanders accountable for addressing them. At the same time, they created the Street Crime Unit to patrol for violent armed criminals and to stop large numbers of people in high-crime neighborhoods to check for guns, and they instructed all officers to crack down on petty crimes like graffiti. Community policing, which makes citizens the allies of the police, was scorned as social work by Mr. Giuliani and abandoned by his second commissioner, Howard Safian. They tried to do all this too quickly, Professor Goldstein said. Without the investment of years of groundwork in refining training and supervision and discipline. Historically, this is a prescription for a runaway police organization. San Diego took almost the opposite approach, he said. By the 1990s, it had already invested heavily in careful training and was already using the kind of statistical crime mapping Mr. Bratton brought later to New York. Our basic premise was, we don't have enough police officers to do it all, so we needed participation by the community, said Jerry Sanders, who retired as San Diego's police chief last year. San Diego has 1.7 officers per 1,000 residents, compared to 5 per 1,000 in New York. Damn! So San Diego adopted community policing after a series of meetings with citizens. The police divided the city into 99 neighborhoods with a police team assigned to each so that residents could get to know their police officers and feel comfortable giving them information. The city also recruited 1,200 volunteers, many of them retired, to watch over neighborhoods. They received police training, wear police-like uniforms, and drive official vehicles. In addition to using crime figures, Mr. Sanders decided to measure his department's success with an annual survey of public satisfaction. The most recent one showed approval at 89%, he said. Boston's approach began with an effort to figure out the real source of crime in the city and how to reduce it with the least racial confrontation. David Kennedy, a senior researcher at Harvard, was hired to help, and he advised focusing on gun violence, not on gangs or drugs, a seemingly small distinction, but a crucial one for enforcement. Mr. Kennedy, along with a team of Boston police officers and representatives of the District Attorney's Office, the United States Attorney's Office, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, began tracing how guns got into the hands of criminals and discovering who was the most serious offenders where. They then began consulting black ministers to win their cooperation in going after the ringleaders. The team included the ministers, ministers now. Keep that in mind, y'all. including the ministers, began inviting known criminals, drug dealers, and young gang members to what they termed call-ins, meetings at which they were warned the violence had to stop or that there would be federal prosecutions. The few who did not heed the warnings have been arrested and are now facing long federal sentences. The number of arrests and confrontations on the street with the police were minimal, Mr. Kennedy said. The program has been so successful that in the past 2.5 years, only one juvenile has been killed by gunfire in Boston. Now, that ain't bad. That's a good result, but is it really strictly the result of the police? I'll say again. Mr. Bratton, who was appointed by Mr. Giuliani in December of 1993 after serving as Boston's police commissioner, said that given New York's high crime rate, an aggressive approach was needed at first. But then, as crime dropped, he said, the mayor made a conscious decision not to put in place the other half of the strategy, reaching out to the black religious and political leaders. The former commissioner, a frequent critic of Mr. Giuliani since his ouster, added, if we had reached out in New York the way we reached out in Boston, we could have not only solved the crime problem, but we could have begun to resolve the racial problem too. The Boston model, which evolved over time, has succeeded in several other cities, including High Point, North Carolina, Indianapolis, New Haven, Memphis, and Portland, Oregon. In High Point, where it has been directed by Walter Halton Jr., a United States attorney, a team like Boston's has called in 150 known criminals and given them warning since it started in December of 1998. Mr. Halton said there has not been a single drug or gangbang related murder. After 9 murders each in 97 and 98, the number of citizens' complaints against the police have been cut in half. It's a very non-traditional approach to law enforcement, Mr. Holden said, and it benefits from the cooperation of the black ministers who have told criminals that if they do not stop breaking the law, don't expect to come hide in my church. Hallelujah. Well, you know what? I'll tell you what, Rev. Better watch it. Better watch it. But more importantly, that article is definitely deficient, from the New York Times, by the way, because what it doesn't talk about is the fact that people learn from their own experiences, that people actually do change. People see where all of that crazy crack shit led them, and they pull back. That's what I see. Now, there's been some repression, but that's what I see. People learned from their experience, bro.
And the whole crack epidemic has been, it just dried out. You can look in many of the major cities where people who were just using it had stopped using it on that same level. You could tell just by how a lot of the communities look and feel a lot healthier than they did in days past. Another thing that often gets left out of the mix is that the Rodney King verdict also had a lot to do with how the gangs, especially in L.A., were dealing with one another. Because that's when a lot of the major truces were called. Now, the police actually did everything they could to neutralize the truces, similar to when the Crips and Bloods originally called the truce back in the day and stuff. That can be seen in a documentary, The Fire Next Time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just scandalous for them to just try
and
to ignore all of these other
Very
issues and stuff that have gone on, and the
Very
shift of
point.
Consciousness in these major events that have taken place, like the Rodney King verdict and the riot that resulted in a shift in consciousness that happened then, and then the crack epidemic and siege just playing itself out.
That's right. In fact, just to comment on one thing that Tracy just said. See, initially, when they had the Crips and the Bloods started having picnics, joint picnics, and the police actually invaded one of the picnics, yelling and screaming about it'll never work. Now, that's not positive.
And also, there was a brother up visiting from L.A. who was part of the truce. He was up at the prison industrial complex, you know, that little two-day conference that happened a while back. And he was describing how the police were targeting the main people who were involved in these truce concessions.
They framed up one of them sent him to prison.
And another got killed.
Mm-hmm. Now, actually, one of the best things to fight crime, the best methods to fight crime has taken place in Los Angeles recently. The chief of Los Angeles Police Department directed the department today, or this was actually March 4th, to disband the semi-autonomous anti-gang units at the heart of the city police corruption and brutality scandal. Now, that's going to do some good. It was called Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums or Crash. See ya, and I wouldn't want to be ya. Now, check this out. Here goes some police, right? The mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, now, has fired the city's police chief after two white officers who shot an unarmed black teenager to death were given departmental awards for valor in the confrontation. These are unarmed black teenagers shot to death by white officers. The chief of police gives them an award for valor. So they fired his ass. Now check it out. The police are having demonstrations in Louisville right now.
It reminds one of when old coward George Armstrong Custer would run around to Indian villages basically killing innocent women and children and old folks. We saw what happened when he faced Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and Two Moon and touched the clouds and them head on. But how he would get all his little awards for just shooting up innocent, unarmed people, basically, in these little squaw villages.
So here's an alert. You hear about this police stuff, time to do something about it. This Wednesday, 4 o'clock, at Powell Street in what is the name of the street? Powell Street in San Francisco, 5th Street. Powell is the name of the exit, right? Powell Street, 4 o'clock, the BART station. Go upstairs and join the demonstration against the murder of Diallo, against all of the injustice heaped upon us by the police departments of the world. It's called March 15th, International Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality. Get off the dime here, folks. If you think that what happened to Diallo was bad, if you think it was wrong, please, by all means, get yourself there. This Wednesday, 4 o'clock. All right? And here is, in fact, a little statement about the Diallo murder from Mumi Abdul-Jabbar. He named his piece Public Servants or Paid Creditors. When are you black folks going to throw off the killers that are jailing you for murder? John Africa from On the Move, Philadelphia Tribune, the 26th of July, 1975. The Amadou Diallo trial of four white cops charged in the firestorm slaughter of the West African has ended in the predictable acquittal of his killers. When is a killing not a killing? Apparently, this is so when the victim is someone slain by the police. When the police kill, it is an accident, a mistake, an oops. Let us examine how the police achieved this judicial sleight of hand. As soon as the case arose, the legal forces defending the state fled to the very area that the police claimed to be serving. Why is it okay, to enforce the law in a given neighborhood, yet automatically wrong to have citizens of that same neighborhood try to enforce, as jurors, some of that same law when it comes to these particular public servants? These four cops fled the jurisdiction as quickly as possible, showing their continued naked contempt for the people that say that they were sworn to serve. Amadou Diallo was quote, served, unquote, by the state, and his name has now become a dark example of the paramilitarism of police power, the deadly wages of the so-called oops factor. In New York City in recent months, black and Latino men have been shot for having keys, candy bars, wallets in their hands. This deadly rain of so-called accidents is an official expression of Negrophobic oppression, and it can only escalate after this unholy acquittal of the four cops from the Bronx. When the case began, the police immediately opted for a bench trial before a judge, not a jury. When an African-American jurist was selected, they put in a change of venue motion that put them in the first thing smoking to Albany in upstate, white bread, New York. So much for the community they serve. The service that the state delivers is death. What of the recent case of the Orthodox Jewish man, Gidon Bush, who was cornered by four cops in Borough Park, New York City? Bush, a newly Orthodox Jew, was shot 12 times outside of his home. Immediately, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, the police commissioner Harry Howard Safir, attacked the dead youth and painted him as a fanatic whose shooting was justified. Key to their justification theory was their claim that Bush attacked an officer with a hammer. Eyewitnesses uniformly disputed this claim, but nonetheless, 3 months after the August 1999 shooting, a grand jury exonerated all four cops and pronounced the killing justified. Welcome to the Terror Dome. The vile and violent attacks on black and Puerto Rican life in the nation's capital of capital cannot long be limited to their communities. Consciousness does not obey the laws of geography, and repression, like water, seeks the lowest level. A conservative, pro-Giuliani Orthodox Jewish community is still essentially a Jewish community. And the social forces that truly run New York regard them as another flavor of difference. Bush's life, like Diallo's life, was expendable in the larger interests of the consolidation and projection of state police power. Both men were genteel souls who couldn't fathom the hatred and vehemence with which they were perceived by the police. Both men were executed twice, once in the streets near home, the next in the court system, where their sacrifice was deemed acceptable to the large political interests of the status quo. According to public reports, one resident in Borough Park confided to a black reporter, and I quote, "Yesterday I believed that when the police would shoot down a black man, they had reason. Now I realize that the police can be animals, that they have the power to cover it up at all costs. The next time a black man gets shot, I'm marching with you." Let us hope that really happens so that a vast movement can be built. Mumia Abu-Jamal. And in fact, the vast movement is being built, and tomorrow the activist Western Regional Conference meeting will take place. That is tomorrow, March 11th, in order to build the May 13th Monster March and Rally in defense of Mumia Abu-Jamal for his freedom. This meeting will take place in San Francisco at Centro del Pueblo, 474 Valencia. 474, that is, Valencia. Starts at 10:30. Please, if you have the time, come on through, because we're trying to plan for this rally to free the man's words you just heard. And once again, don't forget the 15th. And lastly, we have the Secret Service shielding Gore from questions about Mumia Abu-Jamal. On Friday, February 5th, the Al Gore campaign staff had the Secret Service eject two union members from an Oakland, California union hall because the union members said they were going to ask the vice president a question about Ed Rendell and Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a a radio newsman from Philadelphia, currently on Philadelphia's Pennsylvania's death row for a crime that he did not commit. He was convicted in 1982 of killing a police officer in a trial that has universally been described as grotesque and unfair and clearly unconstitutional. Two members of the Oakland Federation of Teachers, AFL-CIO, and the Oakland Educational Association, the OEA, Bob Mandel and Bob Wells, attended the Friday evening rally at the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, the ILW Local 6 in Oakland, where Vice President Gore was to get the endorsement of Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown. They had come to ask the question why, that is Bob Mandel and Bob Wells, wanted to ask Gore why Ed Randell, the Philadelphia district attorney responsible for framing Mumia Abdul-Jamal and an active participant in the planning of the horrific bombing of the Move House on May 13th of 1985, which, by the way, led to the death of 11 people, including 5 children, and burned down an entire city block in a middle-class black neighborhood. They wanted to know how it is that he had been named chairman of the Democratic National Committee and chair of the Democratic Party Convention in Los Angeles in August of this year. Mandel and Wells wanted to ask Mr. Gore if, given this information, he would call on the Democratic Party to remove Ed Randell from these posts. A member of the campaign staff who had seen the two teachers distributing leaflets, including the information mentioned above, asked them if they were going to yell at the candidate. They said no. They just wanted to ask him about Ed Randell during the question and answer period. The staff person retorted, "There isn't going to be a question and answer period," and called a contingent of Secret Servicemen who threatened the teachers with arrest and ejected them from the hall. It was highly improper for the Gore campaign staff to use federal security police to protect their candidate from an issue they did not approve of. It was completely out of line for Secret Servicemen to threaten these union members with arrest for trying to ask the question at a rally in a union hall. Son of a Bush has his supporters tear up the placards of death penalty abolitionists at his rallies while glibly saying he's glad the people came. And Gore's staff uses the Secret Service to exclude Mumia Abdul-Jamal supporters from his rallies. They have the unmitigated gall to call this democracy. It is not. It is the antithesis of democracy and democratic practice. This amounts to political censorship, pure and simple. As it happened after the teachers were ejected, others questioned the vice president from the floor about the death penalty moratorium and about the anti-youth California Proposition 21. At no time was there any genuine problem with security. And that is a special news broadcast. You won't get that nowhere else for Slave Revolt.
And we have one last thing from our Slave Revolt research correspondent, Olive Ledoux. And what she found was that Governor Tommy Thompson, known to many state residents as King Tommy, has announced that, quote, "If keeping criminals off our streets means sending our prisoners to Texas, bye-bye, they're going south," unquote. That's just one of the proposals set forth in the state of address delivered by Wisconsin's chief executive on Tuesday, January 30th, in Madison. He means it, and is about to deal with Texas on this whole concept. Quote, "We have talked with Texas correction officials. They have room for our prisoners. They have agreed to take them, and we're working out the details," unquote. Now, according to Tommy Thompson, quote, "Wisconsin is working better and stronger than at any time in our history."